Crime and Crime Again is a true crime podcast containing subject matter that may be graphic or disturbing. Listener discretion is advised. Joining me today is forensic anthropologist and best-selling author, Dr. Kathy Reichs. Welcome to Crime and Crime Again, and thank you so much for sitting down with me today.
Well, thank you so much for inviting me.
So if you're ready, we can go ahead and jump right in. So tell us a bit about your career and how your path led you to forensic anthropology.
Oh, wow. I started out in bioarchaeology. My specialty, my master's and doctorate are in human skeleton. And I plan to spend my career looking at archaeologically recovered materials, ancient skeletons. But because I was the bones lady at the university, police started bringing me cases. I actually wrote a short story. It's called First Bones. It's in a collection of short stories called The Bone Collection. And it's Temperance Brennan's origin story. But it's also my origin story as well. That's how I started out in forensics anyway. That's how she started out in forensics also.
And I know you've spent a lot of your career teaching and lecturing at different universities. Can you tell us a bit about that?
I spent most of my career at University of North Carolina at Charlotte. I started the books way back in 1994 with Deja Dead because I made full professor at the university. That's the highest rank you can achieve. At that time, I was commuting between Charlotte, North Carolina, and Montreal, Quebec, doing forensic casework at the main medical, legal, and crime lab up there. So in 94, I was free to do something new, and I didn't want to write another textbook or a journal article. And I had a story idea because I had just worked on a serial murder case, which had some very interesting twists to it. So I had the freedom to try something new, and I thought fiction would be fun. I thought fiction would maybe bring my science to a broader audience. I don't think anyone had heard of forensic anthropology back then. So I had a good story idea, and I had the freedom to try something new, and I did. I started Deja Dead in 94. It took 2 years to write it because I was teaching full-time and commuting between two countries doing casework. So then I moved into the world. It got published. My greatest hope was that it would be good enough that someone would publish it. And fortunately, Scribner did. And it went right onto the New York Times bestseller list. So I had moved from academia to the world of crime labs and crime solving. And now I have moved at least one foot into the world of commercial fiction.
You are one of only 100 forensic anthropologists that have ever been certified by the American Board of Forensic Anthropology. Could you tell us a little bit about what the education and career path might look like for someone who wants to establish a career in the field and reach that level of accomplishment?
Well, it's a long haul. You have to have a PhD in at least in physical and biological anthropology. And that takes what? An average of 5 years post undergraduate. Then I think once you get your doctorate, you're required to practice like under the mentorship of a board certified anthropologist for, I think, 3 years. Then you can apply to sit for the exam, and it's a bear of an exam. And if you pass that exam, then you're board certified, and then you're the real deal.
I can imagine it definitely takes a lot of years of schooling and just experience in the field.
Yes, it does. Yes, it does. And yeah.
So just some interesting questions I had about the work in general. Are forensic anthropologists always called out when skeletal remains are found, or are there cases where it's deemed not necessary?
I have had both. I have had police come to me and ask me to go to the scene where remains have been discovered. But I've also had probably more often cases that arrive at the morgue. And I'm asked to be... What the forensic anthropologist works on are remains that are compromised so that a pathologist cannot do a normal autopsy and an identification cannot be done visually by friends or family members. So the anthropologist is called in, and it could be cases that are burned or mutilated or mummified or dismembered or decomposed or maybe just bones. So the anthropologist is asked to tease any information that we can from the bones. Two main questions would be, who is it? Identification. And what happened to that person? Cause or manner of death.
Can you share some of those indicators for determining age, sex, and race of skeletal remains?
Oh boy, in 25 words or less, the most useful parts of the skeleton for gender, for sex determination are the skull and the pelvis. Race ancestry, it's a real slippery concept, but the best indicators of ancestry are on the skull, the facial architecture and the shape of the skull, the dentition. Age, there are age indicators throughout the skeleton, depending on how old the person was when they died. A child would still be developing and growing, and their bones are incomplete and not fully fused together. Once you reach age 30 or so, that is pretty much done, and then you have to look at degenerative changes in the skeleton.
It's all really interesting, and I kind of became interested. Bones may have been my little introduction into wanting to end up with a true crime podcast.
Well, we had a great run with Bones. We were 12 seasons, 246 episodes. We're still the longest running scripted drama in the history of Fox, which is now Disney.
That is a really impressive feat for a show. I actually didn't know that about Bones.
Yes, we're pretty proud of that.
And this is something that I wondered the very first time I actually watched the first episode of Bones. Can you really tell the kinds of sports or other activities someone did from indicators on their bones?
We have a term for it, markers of habitual activity, repetitive activity. If you do the same thing over and over using the same muscles and ligaments, which pull on the bones, yes, that can cause developments that, you can't, I mean, on the show, we came up with some pretty specific hypotheses based on markers of occupational stress, but you can tell, you could say this person did something strenuous with their legs. They were a runner or they were, a jumper or they were whatever. You can't specifically say, I don't think this person was, a jockey who rode, 243 races.
And throughout your career, you've traveled to numerous different countries, which I know that a lot of those places were some of your inspiration for a lot of the books. What is the most memorable place you visited, whether for work or for vacation?
Oh, that's a hard one because I get around. I've been to a lot of different places. I think one of the most interesting it was and memorable was Israel. I went to Israel and did 2 weeks of research when I was writing Crossbones. And I had as a guide a first century Roman occupied Palestine specialist and biblical archaeologist. So they really took me into places where the average tourist isn't allowed to go. That was memorable.
That definitely sounds like a type of honor, I'd say.
Yes, and it was fun. We had a good time too, and Israel's a fascinating place.
Switching over to talking a little bit more about the books, did you always have aspirations of being an author when you first delved into anthropology?
I had no aspirations of being an author. I had very little interest. I love to read. I've always been a reader. But in university, I really wanted to be in the science labs. I wanted to take zoology and physiology and all the ology courses. I avoided literature. I took the obligatory, like, intro to poetry and intro to fiction, but that was it. And then when I moved into bioarchaeology and into academia, I was really focused more on research using the archaeologically derived bones. I didn't plan to become a novelist.
The first novel in the Temperance Brennan series, Déjà Dead, was published in 1997. What was your publishing journey like after you finished writing the book?
Well, I went about it in a way you really shouldn't go about it if you're hoping to get published. When I finished it, I wrote a cover letter. My daughter helped me. We wrote a cover letter and just mailed it off. In those days, you mailed off the whole manuscript. And sorry, that's my puppy in the background. And I mailed it off to Scribner. I told myself, because my daughter knew someone who had a friend who knew someone at Scribner. So fine, we sent it off to Mary Sue. And within, I'd say 10 days, I had an offer from Scribner. So the first publisher to whom I submitted it bought it. So that is not a typical, and I don't recommend that. I don't think publishers really look at materials that are not represented by an agent. So my advice to debut authors would be, you know, get an agent.
Desjardins ended up winning the 1997 Ellis Award for Best First Novel. What was that feeling like? And were you expecting that?
Of course, I wasn't expecting it when I wrote the book. I just hoped it would be good enough that, you know, someone would publish it and then people would buy it and read it and like it. I did not expect it to go right onto the New York Times bestseller list. And I did not expect it to win prize. I thought it was pretty good, but I didn't expect it to win prizes.
Going into the writing, do you tend to know how your books are going to end before you start the actual writing process? Or does the ending kind of write itself as you go?
Well, I write murder mysteries. So it's a bit formulaic. The difference, you know, somebody gets killed and somebody gets caught at the end. The difference is that mine are science driven. The solutions to whodunit are more science driven. So I know how the book's going to end. The bad guy or girl is going to get caught. I don't always know the pathway, how I'm going to get there. I outline maybe the first 6 or 8 chapters of the book, and then I just start writing. I'm not a plotter. I'm a pantser. And then, but I do keep an outline of what I think of as kind of a post-mortem outline. As I'm writing each chapter, as I finish each chapter, I will then add a little paragraph about what went on in that chapter in the outline. So that by the time I finish the manuscript, I do have a full outline chapter by chapter by chapter. So that if I have to go back and see what happened where and make changes and modifications, I'll know, you know, I know how the action is flowing.
Working on a thriller myself, I found that it's really hard. Like, you know, you kind of know how you want it to end and who you want to be the bad guy, but putting all those little hints and the clues and the red herrings throughout the story is probably the most difficult part I've found. Would you agree?
I agree. And not only putting them in, but going back and tying them all off. You can't just leave them dangling. It's fair to use red herrings, but you better explain it. Thriller readers are very savvy. And if you don't tie everything off and you don't explain everything, or if you rely on coincidence, you know, that's, they'll let you know about that.
The science of each case is a massive part of the structure of each book. I feel like I'm learning a lot while I'm reading, and it's a unique experience to feel like you're learning and then also reading a crime thriller. Was emphasizing the science always a goal when you started writing this series?
I always knew I'd put it in. I always knew I would write that kind of thriller, but I also knew that my readers were not, they didn't want to read a textbook. So you have to keep as a scientist, I'm committed to keeping the science accurate, but it also has to be brief and it has to be jargon free. You can't rely on all, the terminology we use amongst ourselves as specialists, and it has to be entertaining. Otherwise you're going to lose their interest in the story. So those are kind of my three rules of thumb. Keep it brief, jargon free, entertaining, kind of the same skills you use in addressing a jury. You don't want to dumb it down, but you want them to understand it and you want to keep their attention.
This might be a difficult question, but what has been your favorite Temperance Brennan novel to write thus far?
That is a tough one. I guess the one that holds the dearest place in my heart, of course, is Desjardins, because that started it all. I had no publisher. I had nothing to motivate me outside of myself. When I wrote that book while teaching full-time at university and commuting between two countries doing forensic casework. So I really had to squeeze it in every spare moment that I had. So, you know, if I had to pick one, I would have to pick the one that was the start of it all.
On the other side of that, what has been the most difficult of all 22 books to write, and what made it so difficult?
The one that's the most difficult is always the one I'm working on at the moment. Right now, I'm working on book 23. And I'm thinking, this is terrible. This is a mess. This is never going to fly. And then eventually, as you get through that, you know, chapter by chapter, my 30, I usually have 35 chapters or so, you know, and then you go print it all out, read it. I still do that. I print it out. I read it on hard copy. I do a lot of notes and editing. You know, then it starts to, you tweak it, you polish it, and then you think, okay, well, maybe this is going to be okay.
Speaking of Déjà Dead, it was published in 1997, and the television show that it inspired, Bones, aired in 2005. And anyone that knows me knows that Bones is my all-time favorite show, and I have probably watched all 12 seasons about 10 times now.
Oh, my. Okay.
It's become kind of a comfort show of mine. When were you first contacted about bringing Temperance Brennan to television?
I had a number of offers prior to the one that I accepted. They just didn't feel right to me. And then when I sat down with Barry Josephson, one of our executive who came to be one of our executive producers, and Hart Hansen, who came to be our showrunner, we just all seemed to be on the same page. We wanted a character-based show. We wanted to create characters that people would feel attracted to, would become engaged with, would care about. We didn't want to just do another police procedural. I wanted to keep the science accurate and plausible. We didn't want our main heroine going to a crime scene in, you know, pantyhose and pumps. And we wanted to put humor in the show. I put humor in all of my books. And it's hard because every book and every episode deals with violent death. So how do you put a humorous touch in there? And it's a very delicate balance. And I think our writers did a brilliant job of it.
Book Tempe and TV Tempe are very different characters. So was it difficult making those changes to her character as she was being written for TV?
No, I think Emily began playing I think of Book Tempe and TV Tempe. And TV Tempe is younger. She's certainly less polished. She's not socially, she's awkward, socially awkward, but she's brilliant. And she's committed to, you know, getting justice for the dead. She shares those characteristics with Book Tempe. But the social awkwardness, the way Emily Deschanel played that role from the very beginning, I think was brilliant. And if, as you say, you binge all 12 seasons, you can't help but notice how she evolved the character and how that character grew and changed over those 246 episodes.
It was definitely a little bit agonizing waiting 6 seasons for Booth and Bones to, you know, make the move.
Well, you can only play that too long. Will they, won't they? You know, and then you've either got a yes, they do, or no, they don't, and move your characters on. Same thing in the book with Andrew Ryan. You know, will they, won't they? And for the first, I don't know how many books, they were not romantically involved. They were just professionally involved, but eventually they got together, and they're in a pretty good place in book 22.
Many of the consistent characters in Bones aren't in the books. So how did all of those characters come about? Are they based on any of the regular characters from the books?
No, they're really not. It's Book Tempe is really separate from TV Tempe. And we do have Hodgins and Angela and Sweets. And those are all come from the minds of our producers and writers for the show.
So now we can get to the star of the show, which is the 22nd installment of the Temperance Brennan book series, and that was just released on August 1st, 2023. It's called The Bone Hacker. Can you tell us a little bit about the book?
Yeah, the book starts out, the action starts out in Montreal. Montreal is the host to an international fireworks festival every year in the early summer. And Tempe and Ryan are out on a little boat on the St. Lawrence River to watch the fireworks because that's a good place to watch them. And then a storm comes up and it's quite a scary scene. And during that storm, unbeknownst to her, a man is struck by lightning and falls into the river. So she gets a call the next day to help ID, to help recover this man, the parts of this man that are in the river. And to help identify him. And he has a tattoo, which she runs through, has someone run through the FBI tattoo database, and it links to a gang in the Turks and Caicos Islands. So she calls down there. The detective comes to Montreal. Tempe keeps saying, you don't have to come to Montreal, but this detective is very persistent, comes to Montreal because she has an ulterior motive. She wants to persuade Tempe to go to the Turks and Caicos because they have a serial killer situation, someone who is targeting young male tourists and hacking off their left hand. So that's part of the bone hacker. But then while she's there, the FBI becomes involved in the investigation, and it becomes obvious there's cybercrime going on. Someone who is hacking into security systems and cyber systems and Wi-Fi systems. So it's kind of a double entendre with the title.
And this book takes place in the Turks and Caicos, which is a country away from Tempe's usual Montreal or North Carolina. Do you enjoy writing the books that take place in other countries, or do you tend to prefer when Tempe is back home?
I like moving her around, and she's gotten around. She's been to Guatemala. Any place I go, I'll never use a setting that I haven't visited myself. So I've gone to Guatemala to exhume a mass grave. Tempe's gone to Guatemala to exhume a mass grave. I went to Afghanistan on a USO tour. Tempe goes to Afghanistan. I've been to the Yellowstone way up in the Northwest Territories near the Yukon. So Tempe goes there in one of the books. So I do like moving her around. Israel. I went to Israel specifically to research for Crossbones, which was the eighth book in the series. So I do like moving her around, and I do like using places with which I'm familiar, but also new places with which I'm not familiar until I go there.
I'd say it's definitely immersive as someone who's never been to the Turks and Caicos. There was a point in the book where you described the police uniforms, and I was trying to picture it, and I couldn't quite picture it quite like exactly in my head. So I looked it up, and I was like, wow, that is that is to a T. And then it's very immersive the way that you describe each location and each side character and just everything about the beach and even the condo. Everything is very descriptive, and I feel like it kind of feels like I'm there without being there.
Well, that's because I was there and I stayed in that condo. And I was very lucky that I had a woman who was Lisa Murchison, was head of the Turks and Caicos Royal Police Detective Division, I believe it was. And she helped me a lot. She really gave me a lot of information and detail about policing in the Turks and Caicos.
Other than Tempe, who was your favorite character to write in this book?
Oh, the monk, you know, Delroy Monk. I mean, he's an interesting guy, so I did enjoy writing him. And it kind of filled that, when I said earlier, I put humor in the books, and it's hard to do because it's about violent crime, but I do it largely through dialogue. And in many of the books, it's Tempe and Andrew Ryan, you know, sparring with each other. Well, in this book, it was Tempe and Monk sparring with each other. And a lot of the dialogue was meant to be witty anyway.
And there was a moment kind of early on that kind of made me laugh out loud. It was, without giving anything away, it was where she said in her head, "Keep it simple, stupid." And it was just, I laughed. That had me rolling a little bit.
The KISS principle, KISS, keep it simple, stupid.
And another thing, without giving anything away, there was a moment in the first half of the book at the end of a chapter where my jaw hit the floor. I was sitting in the living room reading. My husband was in the bedroom and he heard me go, "What?" He was like, "Are you okay out there?" It was just one of those moments in thrillers that you don't see coming. Are those moments difficult to create?
They are, but they're necessary, I think. I like to have plot twists. And sometimes I don't plan them and they come along and they surprise me as I'm writing. And I think, well, wait a minute, if that surprised me, it's probably going to surprise my readers too. So I like to do that. And especially with the ending of the book, if I read a thriller and I figure out the ending before the author tells me, I'm disappointed in that author. I like to be surprised at the end.
I know you said that you were working on the 23rd book. Do we have any kind of potential release for that?
It will be called Fire and Bones. It is, what can I tell you about it? It will take place in Washington, D.C. It will begin with, big surprise, a fire and multiple victims in this fire. And it should be out this time next year, summer next year, late summer.
And do you think there's any more plans for books after that in Tempe's journey?
I am under contract for two more books. Number 20, Fire and Bones, will be one of those. And then I have another one. I'm toying with the idea of not doing a Temperance Brennan book, but taking a character from book 23 and expanding on that character as the main protagonist in book 24. But we'll see.
So those are all the questions I actually have planned. So we're about to wrap up, but a just for fun question, what are you currently reading?
I am currently reading a new author, Lou Bernie, Benny, Lou, oh, this is embarrassing. I can't remember his name. Lou Benny, Bernie, I think it is. And it's quite good. I have not read his. I read a little blurb by an author that likes him, and I respect that author's opinion, so I thought I'd give it a try. I'm enjoying it, and I just ordered a second one of his books.
That about wraps it up, though. So please check out Dr. Kathy Reich's website at kathyreichs.com, which will be linked in the show notes. There you'll find links to all of Dr. Reich's social media and books. The newest installment of the Temperance Brennan series, The Bone Hacker, can be found at most major retailers, and I will link some of those in the show notes as well. I want to say thank you again for joining me today, and it's genuinely a thrill and an honor to get to speak with you.
Well, thank you. It was a pleasure being here.
All sources for this episode will be listed in the show notes. If you'd like to request a case for me to cover, you will also find a link to a case request form. I have officially launched the Patreon page, where for $5 a month, you can get access to all episodes ad-free. And coming soon, patrons will have access to a monthly bonus episode. Don't forget to check out the YouTube channel, where I've been uploading all of my episodes in video format. If you like the show, please consider leaving a rating and a review on Apple Podcasts or Spotify. Reviews are truly the easiest and the best way to support your favorite shows. You can follow the podcast on Twitter at Crime Again Pod, on Instagram at Crime Again Podcast, on Facebook, just search Crime and Crime Again Podcast, and on TikTok at Crime Again Podcast. Thank you so much for listening, and I'll see you in the next episode of Crime and Crime Again.